Chris Boyd. Up next on The Best of Think, what makes a statement racist?
We have to be willing to set a basic definition, for instance, of a racist idea, which I define as any idea that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior, better or worse, right or wrong, you know, that there is something wrong or not wrong with a particular racial group. And so once we set that basic definition, then we can begin to apply that definition to our own ideas.
We'll also talk with scholar Ibram X. Kendi about what we can do to combat racism in various forms and why it's so important that we look at our own actions before judging others. Our Best of Think conversation starts after a short break. Deeply shaped and warped by centuries of white supremacy, it's not good enough to not be a racist. If we oppose racism but fail to actively work to dismantle it, we're part of the problem. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Consider all the well-intended race-neutral policies in this country that haven't yielded equal access to voting rights, to decent schools and jobs and housing and healthcare. What's needed is a shift from not racist to anti-racist. Anti-racism is less about thinking the right way than about doing the right things. Ibram X. Kendi is founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University, a columnist at The Atlantic, and a 2019 Guggenheim Fellow. His latest book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, has been named one of the best of the year by The New York Times, NPR, and other outlets. He joined us in August to talk about it, and today we're listening back to that conversation. Ibram, welcome back to Think.
It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
So I want to make sure I'm clear on the difference between not racist and anti-racist. Do I have it basically right that not racist is about what we think, anti-racist is about what we do?
To a certain extent, and certainly not racist, the essential idea of what we think is we think we're not racist, no matter what
who
we
are.
Yeah, no matter what we just said, no matter what policies we support, no matter what policymakers we support. When people are charged, typically in this country, as being racist, the typical response is, I'm not racist. But an anti-racist would have basic definitions of racist and even anti-racist, have basic definitions of a racist idea. When someone charges them as being racist, they will reflect based on that definition of a racist idea and say, did I just say a racist idea? And if they did, they would admit that they did so, and they would seek to change, to be anti-racist.
How did you realize you needed to write a book about all this?
Well, my last book, as you know, was a history of anti-Black racist ideas over the course of really American history. And that book, I also sort of chronicled the history of anti-racist ideas. So I really showed this clash between ideas, racist ideas, suggesting there was something wrong with Black people, and anti-racist ideas suggesting there was nothing wrong with Black people. And the more I talked about that book, the more I urged people to sort of rid themselves of these racist ideas and adopt more anti-racist ideas. And the more I urged people to adopt anti-racist ideas, the more I encouraged people to be anti-racist. And the more I did so, people were like, okay, I've been taught to be not racist. So tell me a little bit more about being anti-racist. And the more they asked that question, how can I be an anti-racist? The more I realized I needed to write this book.
So you were raised by pretty amazing parents, both Christian pastors, deeply influenced by the soul liberation movement. Were they anti-racist?
I think at times they were anti-racist, and in many ways they were raised to be anti-racist. But I think one of the things that they struggled with, and I think many members of the middle class sort of struggled with, particularly in the 1980s and 1990s, is particularly members of the new Black middle class, as my parents were, the question was, why did they move into the Black middle class and other Black people did not and stayed poor? Why was there still this sort of teeming population of impoverished and working class Black people? And what some members of that Black middle class believed was that there was something wrong with Black poor people. And I think, and part of the reason is because they were constantly told that, that they were more hardworking, that they were more intelligent, and that Black poor people needed to take personal responsibility. And those ideas were circulating. And it was hard not for my parents to consume those ideas and in many ways teach them back to me.
So you write about a speech that won you a prize when you were a teenager that you hate even thinking about now. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I came of age as a teenager in the 1990s. And if there was ever a decade in American history where people really across the ideological aisle to a certain extent, people in both political parties, old people, no matter the race, were condemning black youth, it was the 1990s. That was the decade in which young black men were called super predators, in which young black women were chastised for supposedly having too many babies, in which we were told we didn't value education. And these ideas were mainstream ideas, bipartisan ideas, interracial ideas. And I consumed those ideas, even as a black youngster, even though these ideas were demeaning my own group. And I ended up preaching them back to others when I gave a speech in high school. Actually, I was a senior in high school, and I competed in this Martin Luther King oratorical contest as a senior. And I ended up becoming one of the finalists of this competition and ultimately winning it based on this speech in which I spoke about how black youth didn't value education. So I repeated that, how I spoke about black youth are the most feared in society, that black youth keep climbing the high tree of pregnancy. And it was this litany of anti-black ideas.
And your mostly black audience loved it at the time you meant it. How did you come to kind of unlatch from that and recognize that a lot of those ideas had actually been fed by white supremacy?
I think it was, as I sort of document in How to Be an Anti-Racist, I think it was a series of experiences, whether it was people saying those ideas, particularly people saying them in a clear way, in a way that I didn't like. In other words, it was almost like other people saying them, and it put up a mirror to my own ideas, and I saw my own ideas through the mirror, and I didn't like them, and I realized, you know what, that's not true. And I had developed more of a sense of racial reality through data and study, and I knew to a certain extent that they weren't true. And of course, mentors and people who told me very directly those ideas weren't true. And so I tried to sort of show that. My journey really was really facing those mirrors and being tutored by people.
So lots of people look at laws and policies in this country now and note that they appear to be racially neutral, right? We don't write statutes that dictate where people of color or white people can live or work or go to school. But if the result is that we're not afforded equal opportunities, that means that our laws are still racist, even though they're written to be racially neutral?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the difficulties. And I think one of the ways we can contextualize it is when we think of voter suppression policies that Jim Crow states instituted a century ago, more than a century ago. I'm talking things like poll taxes, like grandfather clauses, meaning if your grandfather was free, you could vote. I'm talking about literacy tests. I'm talking about these policies which had no racial language. But by the 1960s, as a society, generally speaking, people recognized those ideas as racist because of their impact, the outcome that they almost completely disenfranchised black voters. And so that's why I think when we assess a policy as being racist or anti-racist, we should assess it by its outcome. And so a racist policy is a policy that leads to racial inequity. An anti-racist policy is a policy that leads to racial equity. It doesn't really matter, and I don't think we should look for whether it has racial language or not to determine whether it's racist or anti-racist.
So you identify segregationist thinking and also assimilationist thinking as forms of racism. I think a lot of people listening are accustomed to what you describe as segregationist thinking, recognizing that that is racist. Assimilationist thinking might require a little more careful thought from people. So will you talk about the difference between the two?
Sure. So ironically, there's been this debate within racist thought about why, let's say, black people are inferior. And, you know the old nature versus nurture debate?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually existed within racist thought. In other words, segregationists have historically said Black people are inferior by nature. That's in their genetic sort of biological makeup. And therefore, their inferiority is permanent. And therefore, their inferiorities are causing the racial inequities. And therefore, those inequities are permanent. While assimilationists have said, you know what? Black inferiority is the result of nurture. It's the result of the environment of the culture that Black people are raising themselves in, that pathological culture or even barbaric culture. It's the result of the environment, as people would say now, of poverty. And so if we take the people out of this environment that is literally making them inferior, behaviorally inferior, and we civilize and develop them, then they can become equal. And segregationists, of course, have said, no, we can't civilize and develop these people. All we can do is deport them, segregate them, incarcerate them, or enslave them. And assimilationists are like, no, we should welcome them in and civilize and develop them. While anti-racists, looking really on the outside of this mainstream debate, have historically said, there's nothing wrong with Black people or any other racial group. That's a racist idea. And the only thing all racial groups need are opportunities and resources.
Do you think white people find it necessary to sort of fail to recognize themselves as white so often?
Because I think that's the function of whiteness in and of itself. Whiteness has historically been basically humanity, right? When particularly Enlightenment thinkers and other thinkers who really sort of created conceptions of whiteness and even conceptions of justifications for white supremacy, they were not saying this is what white people think, this is white culture, this is white history, this is white literature. No, they were saying this is what people think, this is history, this is literature. And so generally speaking, the effect of whiteness as a sort of supremacist project has been to normalize it, has been to make it such that it's the standard so that, for instance, other cultures aren't sort of understood from their own cultural standard. They're measured against this sort of normal standard of whiteness, which in a way trains us to be assimilationist because we think we need to civilize, or I should say people who have these ideas, because then they think they need to sort of civilize these other groups of people.
What other people these days refer to as microaggressions, you call racist abuse, which is certainly a term that doesn't mince words. Talk a little bit about why you prefer that term racist abuse to microaggression.
Well, I think anyone who's been in an abusive relationship in which, you know, the person you're with is just constantly and regularly doing things that harm you, either emotionally or even physically, that demean you, that make you feel bad, that essentially causes you to feel distressed, and it's constant, it's regular. And microaggressions are typically regular. I mean, for me as a Black male, when I'm sort of running, when I'm jogging in the morning and I see people moving to the other side of the street, or when I get on the bus and people don't want to sit next to me, or when I go through TSA and they want to go through my hair, or when I get on an elevator with somebody and they fear me. I mean, these are constant things that, of course, affect me. Mm. And even though when you think about them individually, they don't seem that big of a deal. But when you think about them collectively, it's abusive.
I'm Chris Boyd, and we're listening back to my conversation from August with Ibram X. Kendi about his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. When we return, Kendi describes the difference between behavior and culture when talking about race.
When people say things like Black behavior, it really doesn't make any sense because you have lazy people and loving people and dangerous people who have those, I should say, behaviors across racial groups. And so if we want to think about distinctions, we can find distinctions in culture. But when we think about cultural distinctions, we're not talking about human qualities like laziness and criminality. We're talking about things like food and philosophy and other things of that sort.
That's when the best of Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest is Ibram X. Kendi. His latest book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist, and he joined us in August to talk about it. Let's go back to that conversation. Instead of the phrase achievement gap, you suggest we look at the opportunity gap between white students and students of color. It's so interesting the way that single word substitution creates this whole new context for understanding what the problem is and what we might do about it.
Yeah, and, you know, in How to Be an Anti-Racist, I tell this story when I was a senior in college, and I decided I wanted to pursue graduate school, and I had somehow figured out that if I took a prep course, a high-priced prep course, that I could do better on the GRE exam, because I didn't do too well on the SAT, and I would go to the class. And then after the class, I would work out. And I realized in that the teachers weren't necessarily teaching me to be smarter, as I thought that they would, so I can do better on the test, because I thought the test really demonstrated who was smarter. In fact, the teacher was teaching me basically how to take the test, which equated in weightlifting to form, which then allowed somebody who has better form can essentially lift more weights than somebody who potentially is stronger than them. In the same case, I knew how to take the test. And so even if somebody knew more vocabulary words or was better math whiz, I was essentially going to get a better score. And, you know, the test prep industry, right, is a multi-billion dollar industry. And it's proven to help kids improve their scores. And it just so happens that test prep companies and tutors are concentrated in white and Asian neighborhoods. And it's also not a coincidence that they receive the best scores on these tests. And this is an open secret. But then we somehow still imagine that Black and Latinx kids are intellectually inferior as proven by these tests, when that's not necessarily the case.
There are also a lot of assumptions made about crime rates among Black and Latinx kids. And you note that the strongest determinant of crime rates in any given area is not race, it's poverty.
It is. And you mentioned how changing the term academic achievement gap to opportunity gap changes the problem and the solution. It's the same thing when we think of the term dangerous Black neighborhood. Hmm. Well, what if we change the term to dangerous unemployed neighborhood? That also changes the problem and solution, because there's really no relationship between Black people and violent crime, to give an example, which shows itself when you have a upper income Black neighborhood. They're not going to have the same levels of violent crime as an impoverished Black neighborhood. And that's the same case in white America and Asian America, Native America and Latinx America. And so what we do see is you have higher levels of unemployment, particularly long-term unemployment. You're going to have higher levels of violent crime. But we've been taught to think that the Blackness of the people was causing the violent crime, that there's something wrong with Black people, when that's not necessarily the case.
If there is no inherently Black behavior or white behavior or Asian behavior or Latino behavior, how do we put the effects of culture into the proper context without making the mistake of like stereotyping any given individual under any circumstance?
Sure. So I think one of the ways we can understand the difference between behavior and culture, and I try to sort of to talk about those differences in the book, is that culture is something that groups do, and behavior is something that pretty much everyone, every human being does. Hmm. And typically, that human behavior is different in different cultures. In other words, what love looks like is different in each culture, but every human being loves or does not love. And so I think that's how, when people say things like Black behavior, it really doesn't make any sense, because you have lazy people and loving people and dangerous people who have those, I should say, behaviors across racial groups. And so if we want to think about distinctions, we can find distinctions in culture. But when we think about cultural distinctions, we're not talking about human qualities like laziness and criminality. We're talking about things like food and philosophy and other things of that sort.
Sometimes you hear white people say that they're reluctant to talk about race in racially mixed company because they are inevitably going to feel guilt and shame. Is there a role for guilt and shame in our path toward becoming anti-racist?
I think that there can be a role, but I guess in how to be an anti-racist, and I don't actually think at all about guilt. I'm more focused on people taking an accounting of themselves and their own racist ideas and recognizing that in many ways they were manufactured, they were trained to be racist by people who benefited from them being racist. Mm. And so they can sort of see, instead of feeling guilty, in a way I think people should in a sense feel duped, because it's sort of, they're looking out at the world and all of these racial groups as better or worse than them, when that's not true. And then we can start to think, well, who taught me to think that way? Like, who taught me to hate this group? Who taught me to think black neighborhoods are dangerous? And what did they have to gain from me thinking that way? And so I think people can then liberate themselves, because when you have racist ideas, as we're seeing today, you're easily controllable and you're liable to harm people.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Let's go first to Veronica in Seguin, Texas. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Like you said, I'm here in Texas, and I've begun to open my eyes to a lot of these things, understand them better now than I did a year ago, but I also know a lot of people who are still very closed-minded and hold damaging ideas and don't see privilege, really. Like, how would you recommend going about starting these conversations with people who are still very closed off without, you know, pushing them farther away?
Thanks for calling.
That's a very important question. I think that first and foremost, we have to build relationships with people, particularly closed-minded people, because they have to get to a point in which they're willing to open up to us, in which they're willing to share their vulnerabilities, in which they're willing to self-critique, in which they're willing to accept critique. And that encompasses building relationships and, more importantly, building their trust. But I think as we're building people's trust, we should really think about, okay, why do they have those damaging ideas? Like, what purpose does that serve in their life? Because typically, they're explaining something in their life with those ideas. In other words, I'm financially struggling right now because of those Latinx immigrants. So it's explaining that fundamental economic struggle. And so when they open up to us, we can then talk about, well, actually, this is actually, this policy, these people are actually behind your economic struggle, and here's the evidence. And I think that's much more effective, because we're literally meeting them and speaking to them exactly where they are.
That self-critique is really hard, though, right? I mean, as a white person, it's really easy for me to find other white people and what they're doing that is not anti-racist. It's much harder to turn that mirror back on myself and sort of look critically at the mistaken apprehensions I've had, at the things that have been invisible to me that I've been benefiting from.
It is very difficult. And I think one of the reasons, one of the ways we make it, I don't know if easy is the best term, but easier is by setting basic definitions. And I think that we have to be willing to set a basic definition, for instance, of a racist idea, which I define as any idea that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior, better or worse, right or wrong, you know, that there is something wrong or not wrong with a particular racial group. And so once we set that basic definition, then we can begin to apply that definition to our own ideas. And we also, I should say, what's critical is we should not continue to believe that the term racist is a fixed category, that the term racist is a tattoo, that, yo, if I accept that I'm racist, somebody's going to paint that racist word on my forehead and I'm going to be that for the rest of my life and everybody's going to see it, that racist is a bad person, that racist is a white supremacist, that racist is an attack, that racist is a racial slur. All of these ideas were actually created by white supremacists. Hmm. To give an example, Richard Spencer, who coined the term alt-right and sort of one of the leaders of the alt-right movement, helped organize the Unite the Right rally, which, of course, brought all that violence to Charlottesville 2 years ago. He once said that racist is a descriptive term. Racist is not, I'm sorry, a descriptive term. It is a pejorative term. It is the equivalent of saying, I don't like you. No, racist is a descriptive term. It describes what a person is saying. And if in one moment they're speaking about racial hierarchy, they're being racist. But if in the very next moment they're speaking about racial equality, they're being anti-racist. We change.
Some scholars have said that racism against white people by people of color in a society dominated by whites is effectively impossible because racism is something that can only be embodied by people with power. You have a different take on that.
I argue that people of color have power, and every individual person of color has the power to resist white supremacy, has the power to resist racist policies, have the power to resist racist policymakers. And some people of color do not use that power because they think the problem is other people of color, is because they think the problem is their own racial group. And then secondly, there are people of color who are in policy managing positions. In other words, I'm an admissions executive, I'm an admissions official. I haven't created the racist policies, but it's my job to carry them out. And you have some people of color who refuse to do so and look for another job and refuse to sort of carry out that racist policy. And you have others who do out of self-interest to maintain their job, to rise up on the ranks. And then you have policymakers who are people of color, who have the power to shape and break policy. Most notably, obviously, a Supreme Court justice who's black, who, if he would have voted differently, the anti-racist movement and movement for equality in this country would be much further along than it really is. So I actually speak very directly against the premise that people of color don't have power.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There are so many things in this book that just really, I found it fascinating because it causes one to think in a different way. We're kind of like the standard narratives that we have surrounding a lot of things just get into us like grooves and we don't even realize it. So, for example, there are people who say, who argue that there must be something wrong with American black culture because immigrant Africans, immigrant black people tend to do better than black Americans. And you say we really need to flip that question entirely.
Yes. And so I think that what an anti-racist, what a racist would say is, why is it that black immigrants seem to be doing better than African Americans? And they would say, because racism doesn't exist. They would answer their own question. While an anti-racist would say, well, why is it that even though black immigrants have the highest level on average of educational attainment, they're the most likely to be unemployed. Hmm. Why is that the case? And what an anti-racist would also recognize is that immigrants, as sociologists have found, are typically a uniquely resourceful and industrious group of people. In other words, when sociologists have studied immigrants and compared them to the natives they left behind in their own countries and the natives they were essentially going to be with in their new countries, they found that immigrants had uniquely positive sort of behavioral traits. And so what actually is happening with black immigrants is happening with all immigrants in that their success is not a function of something being wrong with African Americans as much as something being right about immigrants.
All right, let's go back to the phones. David is calling us from Trophy Club, Texas. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question is this. There was the incident at OU up in Oklahoma a few years ago where a fraternity boy, a student, was singing a song using the N-word. It went viral. He was expelled. I think his family had to move. And I read a really good response to that, I think. It was written by, a professor here in Dallas at SMU, an African-American woman, who said that an opportunity was blown to, instead of banishing him, engaging him in dialogue. And something earlier you said in this conversation triggered that for me. I just wonder what your thoughts are about that particular incident.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, man. Well, I think it's actually a very sort of complicated issue because on the one hand, on college campuses, and, you know, I'm a professor on a college campus, if we do not have sort of zero tolerance policies that necessitate when someone does something that we talked earlier about the term racist abuse, if somebody doesn't essentially get expelled for that, then it almost emboldens other people to continue to do those things. And then people of color have to constantly sort of deal with racist abuse at the same time they're trying to sort of get an education. On the other hand, obviously, everything can be used as a sort of as a teachable moment. But the question is, are we seeking to sort of help that single student? Are we seeking to help white students learn more about racism, or are we seeking to protect students of color? And I think depending on your focus, meaning the question that you're asking, is going to determine the answer. Because obviously those who are seriously committed to sort of trying to educate particularly racist white students, they're going to use that as a teachable moment. Others who are seeking to protect students of color so this doesn't happen again, meaning have a very strong response to prevent other people from doing something similar, will actually champion that action.
Can anti-racism do anything to motivate racists who aren't interested in changing?
People tend to ask me, you know, who did I write this book for? And I typically say I wrote it for open-minded people. And I wrote it for people who are looking out at this country, who are recognizing the racial strife, who are recognizing that people are dying literally as a result of racism, who are recognizing the harm that American racism has done to America's democracy, who in some ways are finding themselves saying some things that they're ashamed of, that they recognize are racist, even though they don't want to sort of call themselves that. And they want the nation to change, and they're interested in potentially changing themselves. These are open-minded people who are serious about reconstructing themselves and this country. And those are the people that I write for.
I'm Chris Boyd, and we're listening back to my conversation with Ibram X. Kendi about his latest book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. When we return, Kendi talks about the work that goes into becoming an anti-racist.
It's certainly not an easy one, and it really goes against the grain, a grain in this society where we're sort of taught that the problem is people and not policy and power, that we are somehow better than other groups of people if we're different than them, or if they're struggling, that if we have more, it's because we are more. These are ideas where really have been ingrained in us, and to be anti-racist is to reject those ideas. And so it's difficult, and so somebody has to be committed to this, has to be open-minded, has to be open to starting this in order to finish it.
That's when the best of Think continues. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest is Ibram X. Kendi. His latest book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist, and he joined us in August to talk about it. Let's go back to that conversation. Ibram, you were saying you wrote this book for open-minded people.
Yeah, open-minded people, because obviously the process of being anti-racist is certainly not an easy one, and it really goes against the grain, a grain in this society where we're sort of taught that the problem is people and not policy and power, that we are somehow better than other groups of people if we're different than them, or if they're struggling, that if we have more, it's because we are more. These are the ideas where really have been ingrained in us, and to be anti-racist is to reject those ideas. And so it's difficult, and so somebody has to be committed to this, has to be open-minded, has to be open to starting this in order to finish it.
Is it equally challenging for people of all races to be anti-racist?
I actually think so. And I think, you know, I know from talking to people of color and seeing the reception of this book by people of color, that the process, of course, of really getting rid of these ideas that we have internalized is not an easy thing. And And there's so many speakers within communities of color that are sort of lecturing us that, you know, we need to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and that there's something wrong with our behavior and our culture and we need to be better. And these people, of course, have massive followings and they sound so believable. And it's hard to reject them and to say there's nothing wrong with Black people or there's nothing wrong with Latinx people. It's difficult, I think, for many people to come to grips with that.
You say it's important to learn to discern the difference between racist power and white people. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I define racist power. You know, as you know, I try to hang the book on definitions because we oftentimes have these conversations about race and we have not really settled on basic definitions. But I define racist power as basically racist policymakers. So people who are in positions of power and use their power to institute policies that lead to racial inequity. And then you have white people. And so there are some white people in positions of power. Now, white people typically are disproportionately in positions of power, but not all white people are in positions of power. And obviously, and so the question is, should the anti-racist sort of movement be challenging white people, even those white people who really don't have positions of policymaking power, or racist power? And I argued consistently in the book that the focus should not be on white people, some of whom are actually victims of racist policies, but it should be on racist power. When I say white people are victims of racist policies, I mean something like, for instance, you have policies like voter suppression policies that not only suppress disproportionately the votes of people of color, but it also ends up suppressing the votes of white people.
You write that it's impossible to know racism without understanding its intersection with capitalism. So what does money have to do with it, and how is an anti-racist to respond?
Sure. And I think we struggle to have a serious and a real conversation in an honest conversation about racism. We struggle and refuse to have a real and honest conversation about capitalism and what capitalism is. And it's difficult for us to define both. And we're arguing over definitions as it relates to both. As an historian, I found that really the origins of capitalism and the origins of racism are pretty much the same. They emerged at the same time, in the same place. Western Europe in the 15th century grew together, reinforced each other through mechanisms like the slave trade, through mechanisms like slavery and colonialism. And these are both racist systems as well as systems of capitalism. And so I've found that you can't really separate racism from capitalism. And I think that when we really, truly begin to have an honest conversation about what capitalism is, I think more Americans will see that.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Rebecca is calling from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
So I had a question about discussing race and describing race for teenagers. For instance, mm-hmm. my son goes to a magnet school in Dallas that is very diverse. He just got a first love interest, and being the nosy mom, I wanted to scope her out and check her out just because I'm nosy. Mm-hmm. As she walked out of the school, and he said she has brown hair and a blue shirt. And at the same time as he's saying that, two girls with brown hair and blue shirt walk out. One is black, one is white. And I said to him, which one? Is she black or white? And his text response was, that's very racist. And I don't know how to explain to him in this timing, in this culture right now, that it's okay to describe someone and that's not racist.
What do you think, Ibram?
So actually, we're having a debate right now over that very issue. To give an example, I think a columnist in the Wall Street Journal, Heather McDonald, recently wrote an essay making the case that Donald Trump is not racist, because Donald Trump does not use racial categories. In other words, he doesn't categorize people typically by race in his speeches, in his policies. And those who categorize by race are the real racist. That was pretty much her argument. And that has historically been the argument of racists, particularly in the last 50 years. But if we don't, and this is the way I would explain it to a teenager as I would explain it to an adult, how can we as a society collect data that shows racial inequities if we don't identify by race? It's impossible. And so in order for us to essentially have data showcasing and showing racial inequities and disparities, we have to identify by race. And then once we have racial inequities, we can then look for the racist policies that are causing them. And then once we can find those racist policies, we can begin to eliminate them. But the first step is identifying by race. And actually, not identifying by race is potentially the last step in the process of anti-racist, as opposed to the first step.
How did we get so mixed up about that?
I think because, again, we've been trained to think that. We have writers right now who are making this case because they're trying to somehow argue that a person who constantly demeans particular racial groups in coded language is not racist, while people who talk about white supremacists are indeed racist because they use the word white. I mean, this is the environment we're living in. But it unfortunately, we have to identify by race to see racism. And there's no other way around that.
You write in the book that you went through a stage where you sort of thought of all white people as the devil. Can you talk about, like, why you came to the realization that that maybe wasn't helpful to building a more anti-racist world? I'm sure there were a lot of instances that fed that perception for you.
Yeah, I graduated high school thinking that black people were the problem. That there was something wrong with black people, and I was trying to figure out what was wrong with black people. And then I was a freshman in Tallahassee, Florida, at Florida A&M University, when the election of 2000 happened. And of course, the election of 2000, when so many black votes were suppressed or spoiled, and I heard so many stories from classmates whose parents back home and friends who, of course, weren't allowed to vote. And I heard these stories, and typically the villain in these stories was a white police officer or a white poll worker or a white lawyer. And ultimately, I was like, you know what? There's something wrong with white people, too. They are devils. There's something wrong with them inherently. And so then I thought there was something wrong with both black people and white people. And I thought there was something wrong with everyone, that they were both the racial problem. Mm. And ultimately, I realized that the fundamental problem was not people, that the fundamental problem was policies, the policies that allowed for what happened in the election of 2000, the powerful people who allowed that election to swing to George W. Bush, that this was the fundamental problem that was causing our racial strife that I had been sort of searching for really my whole young life.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You also came to a recognition that black people should recognize that neither poor blacks nor elite blacks are somehow the truest representatives of black people. Why are those assumptions about who sort of represents any one racial group so fed by racist ideas? On either side, I should say, it could be any race that we're talking about.
Sure, because I think historically, the way in which racist ideas have proliferated has been through us seeing those stereotypes in individuals. In other words, the racist idea that black people are violent. So what happens is we see an individual black person acting violently. And instead of saying that's an individual black person acting violently, we say what? Black people are violent. Hmm. That going from the individual to generalizing has been a fundamental aspect of a racist idea. So essentially what we're saying about that individual is they represent the race. And so there's a recognition, I think, among Black people and among other people of color that every individual is, in a sense, being forced to represent the race. And obviously, if your Black race is being assessed, let's say, by the white middle class, and the Black middle class seemingly sort of shares more behavioral traits and values and even to a certain extent culture with the white middle class, then the Black middle class is going to be like, no, they're not the representatives. We're the representatives of Blackness. And so I think that's how that sort of happened. And I was trying to make the case that there is really no representative of the Black race, of the white race, of any race.
You share at the end of the book that you went through treatment for stage 4 cancer while you were writing this. And I'm really glad to hear that you're doing okay, that you're fighting. I was so struck by the metaphor you draw between racism and cancer. I don't know if you have it verbatim, maybe you do, but can you talk about how you look at racism in a way that is quite similar to how you look at stage 4 cancer?
Sure. So, yeah, I had metastatic cancer, which, of course, meant that it spread. And I would argue that America has metastatic racism, and the cancer cells of racial inequity and injustice have literally spread to every part of our body politic. And I somehow was able to, even though I didn't have any risk factors, stop denying that I had this serious disease, which, of course, was the first step in fighting it. And I think America needs to stop denying how serious this metastatic racism truly is. And then secondly, when doctors typically treat metastatic cancer, they typically have a local treatment, meaning they go in and surgically remove racist policies as we could, like literally just remove them, identify them and remove them in the way they remove tumors. And then there's also a systemic treatment. In other words, they flood the body with chemotherapy to reduce the size of tumors or to kill tumor cells that they can't see, which is essentially like we could flood the body with anti-racist policies, policies that reduce racial inequity, policies that create equity to essentially heal the body systemically of racism. And then we can watch the body closely and make sure no cells, cancer cells of inequity return.
You can't really let your guard down after you've had cancer. Not entirely.
You can't. You can't, because it can always be a reoccurrence.
So what do you give our chances of getting over racism in this country?
So I believe that America can survive racism. And I say survive because I think, particularly this summer, I think some people are really finally beginning to realize just how harmful, you know, racist ideas and really racism truly has historically been in this country. But I think we can survive it because we have to believe we can survive it. Like, in order to do this hard work, in order to go through the pain that's essential to healing, we have to believe there's another side. And I believe there's another side.
That was my conversation with Ibram X. Kendi about his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. He joined us in August. If you enjoyed this show, check out our conversations with Angela Saini about her book, Superior, The Return of Race Science, and with Jamil Zaki about his book, The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. Those podcasts are on our website, think.kera.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.